All right. Thanks everyone for joining us. Welcome to our June. I'm trying to remember what month we were in there. We're just talking about it, our June thought leader interview. And a big thank you to John Simmons, who will be speaking with us this hour. So John is Executive Director for Research and Economic Development at Alfred University. So this interview is an element of IRI's digitalization community. Through the DXC, you can access case studies and white papers with fresh, relevant content. A virtual con sorry, go a I keep saying virtual. We're not in person. We're going to be in person in the fall, and it's dedicated to digitalization. It's the Digital Futures Conference, and it's going to be October 11th through the 13th at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. We also have facilitated roundtable discussions on key topics, and I hope you'll join us tomorrow for our June roundtable. If you'd like an invitation to that, just pop me an email. We do updates and insights and additional resources, and we do webinar interviews with thought leaders like we're doing today. And these always take place on the third Thursday of the month at noon Eastern. And I'll be sure to sign all of you up for updates if you're not already on the mailing list. Just a few housekeeping items to get through here. First, the session is being recorded and you will get a link to the recording. We will also be distributing the recording as a podcast, so there will not be any visuals here today. Second, please hold all questions until the end. Once we open the floor to questions, you can type your question in and I'll read it out for you, or you can just unmute yourself and turn your camera on and join us for a conversation. All right, all that's out of the way. John, thanks for joining us today.
Sure.
So tell us about your background and how you became interested in augmented reality in particular.
Well, it's kind of an odd story. I'm a working class kid from out in the middle of nowhere, and growing up in the 70s, my only outlet was basically reading. And one of the two things I read every month was popular science and popular mechanics. And I don't remember which one, but one of them did an article on a fellow named Ivan Sutherland, who was at MIT, I think, at the time, who created something called the Sword of Damocles, which was a computer that kind of hung from the ceiling over his head. And he wore some glasses, and he could take a parallelepiped and project it in front of him in space and kind of spin it and stuff like that. And I thought that was one of the coolest things ever. So I put it in the back of my mind that if I ever had a chance to work in that, I would happily do so. And 45 years later, I got that opportunity.
That's awesome. And your role now at Alfred?
What I do at Alfred is I work as kind of an interface between the university and industry, trying to provide them intellectual and financial support on their projects, with a particular focus on the glass and ceramic industry in New York. Alfred University has historically has been a leader in glass and ceramics and glass and ceramic research. I also have an economic development role, trying to help startup companies in the area and or bring companies in from other states.
Okay, and before that, you were at EPRI, right?
Yeah, before that, I've been at Alfred about 3 years and 3 months. Prior to that, I spent 10 years at the Electric Power Research Institute, or EPRI, and our lab, the lab I worked at, was in Knoxville, Tennessee. And that's where I kind of picked up on augmented reality again. When my previous experience had been at a utility, and then I went and joined EPRI. And at the time I joined EPRI, BlackBerry was the big dog on the block, and we all had BlackBerries. And about a year and a half, 2 years into it, the IT guy shows up and he says, "I need your BlackBerry." So I hand him my BlackBerry and he says, "Now you have an iPhone." And he turns around and walks out like they do. And so I'm looking at this iPhone and I kind of messed around with it. I see, oh, there's an app store. So I started looking through the app store and I'm scrolling. And all of a sudden I see the words augmented reality. And I'm like, hey, I wonder what that is. So I hit it and it was an application that you could hold your iPhone up and look through it and see where the nearest fast food restaurants are. So you could turn and look and it would say, oh, there's a Taco Bell 1.1 mile over there, and or there's a McDonald's over here, and that kind of thing. And I got to thinking, gee, if you could project icons and information about fast food restaurants on reality, could you do something like that with utility assets using information from the geospatial information system, or GIS? And I talked to a buddy of mine who was a very good developer, and we agreed that it could be done. And I went out and kind of EPRI's role in the world as we talk to utilities and see if there's technology that they're interested in, and then kind of propose a collaborative research in that area where we pull together monies from different areas. And we did that, and we got four utilities to each pitch in $50,000 or something. And a couple months later, we came out with an augmented reality app that you could use on an iPhone or an iPad, and you could get information about where a given asset was, and you could get information about the work that needed to be done on that, or what the status was. And you could essentially interface with three or four back office systems, like the asset management system, the outage management system, the time management system. And so we're kind of off to the races. That project went well, but most utilities, they used to rib me that it was, you know, some sort of a kid's game. Augmented reality is just a kid's game, blah, blah, blah. And then oddly enough, two or three years into this, along came Pokemon Go, which was an augmented reality app for kids. And all of a sudden, you know, their kids were coming up to them and saying, look, mom, look, dad, augmented reality. And the light bulb kind of went on, and they're like, augmented reality? That's what that Simmons guy was talking about for the last 3 years, right? So all of a sudden, the phone started ringing, and we put together a much larger project to look at both ergonomics and economics of augmented reality use in the utility space, which of course has a range of activities from land management and construction and complex assembly tasks and troubleshooting and all of this kind of stuff. And so we did use cases in all those different areas, and we measured productivity gains and looked at what's the impact on learning curves, how quickly could they pick it up, how easily they could pick it up, whether it was eye strain issues, any kind of issues about wearing, you know, headsets or holding a device while you're doing work, and situational awareness. Does it take away from situational awareness, or can we improve situational awareness? And we did that, and I believe we had 14 utilities all around the world working on it. And that was probably one of the pinnacles in my life. I have a really broad definition of augmented reality. When people say, what is augmented reality? I kind of give a glib answer of anything that augments your reality. But there's really some truth to that, in that you should be able to assist with the perception of reality for a worker without taking away anything. And augmented reality not only covers like visual cues, visual data, visual instructions, but it can also be auditory or even haptic. In other words, say your worker wanders into a restricted area or an area where they need some sort of protective equipment, PPE. They can get a vibration on something to tell them that, hey, you got to stop now and think about safety. So it really, the definition, as silly as it is, it really is anything that augments your reality, that increases your awareness of what's going on around you and improves communication back between the person in the field or the person in the floor and the management. Okay. So, you've all seen augmented reality. If you watch baseball or football, you know, you can see the line of scrimmage marker and the first down marker, and you see the time and everything on there. And also in baseball, you can see the strike zone and the speed of the pitch. But if you notice that we've gone from or to that where you're getting this information and it's not taking away anything. If you remember years ago, they would put up kind of a frame around the, say you're watching football, frame around the game, and you would see how many downs, how many yards to go, the time and all that stuff, but it would block out part of the screen. So you were actually getting less of the game and more of the information. Well, the neat thing about the augmented reality is if it's done right, it can blend in with what you see and actually, as the word implies, augments what you see without really detracting. In other words, you can see in a line of scrimmage, but you can still see everybody lined up on it. So another example is the backup camera in your car, if you got one. They started off with just a camera, and eventually they came to this an augmented reality view that actually shows you how, as you're backing up and you're turning, you're being guided around obstacles and such. And again, it does it in a way that is, you know, an additive to your experience rather than a subtractive from your experience. So, you know, most people have encountered augmented reality. They're just not really aware of it.
Well, I have spent a fair bit of time on Pokemon Go. I'm not afraid to admit I'm pretty good, actually. But, you know, that's a conversation for another day.
Well, it's so, my, you know, it's funny. My I had a 14-year-old, my 14-year-old son said, "Hey, Dad, let's go out for pizza." And I'm like, okay, you know, and like most fathers of a 14-year-old boy were like, okay, what's up with that? So we go to this pizzeria in downtown Knoxville, Tennessee, and we're eating pizza. But then I realized what he wanted me to do was take him, because he had a very specific pizzeria in mind. He wanted me to take him to an area where there were these Pokemon that he could interact with his Pokemon Go. So became very aware of the capabilities of Pokemon Go.
It's very good. And I'm sure that pizza place knew what it was doing too.
Yes.
So what are the main use cases that you see for AR in R&D and also, you know, manufacturing on the shop floor? You mentioned a bit about safety, but where else do you see some interesting examples of how it could be used?
Well, the first thing that augmented reality was applied to was complex assembly tasks. And that was by Boeing. Boeing, a guy by the name of Tom Caudill, actually coined the term augmented reality in working on the 757 project, where they were spending all their time going from the assembly area to file cabinets that might be two or three buildings away and coming back. And it was just a really slow process. So Boeing did some very seminal work, now 15 years ago, on the improvement in productivity in complex assembly tasks. And they took a simulated wing, and they had their workers, you know, different groups of workers, try to do an assembly task using it, using the augmented reality, using paper copies, using essentially the paper copies on a computer sitting next to them. And the results were just astounding. The increases in productivity and the decrease in errors were very dramatic. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that when your workers are using the augmented reality, typically they don't have to take their eyes off of what they're doing. You know, even with a computer sitting beside them, they got to constantly be looking over. And in a lot of cases, trying to take a two-dimensional rendering of their workspace and try to apply it to their three dimensions. So that was the first use case. But in the utility space, we expanded this in a lot of different directions. We had one application with a New York company, a New York utility, where we integrated an augmented reality glasses to some sensors. Actually, they were smart clothing used in the sports and health and sports industry. And a foreman could monitor the pulse and the blood oxygen level and all this kind of stuff of his entire crew, and in some ways detect when they were about to have a heat incident. Because the, you know, most linemen are out there, they're big burly guys, almost 100% male, and none of them want to be the first guy to sit down in the shade and take a drink or whatever, so they will work themselves until somebody drops. And so the foreman has to be very attuned to the health status of his crew. And so if there was an increase in somebody's dramatic increase in somebody's blood pressure or whatever, he could look around and actually see overlaid on reality the direction that worker is with regards to him. So that was a pretty cool one. But we did have a lot of success in asset repairs and outage management. You know, when there's a large scale outage at a utility, the first thing they do is they go out and do an assessment, a storm damage assessment, which means everybody with a pulse goes out in trucks and starts writing down on NCR pads, you know, what the damage is. Then at noon, they bring them back and somebody starts typing them into the, you know, their work management system or whatever. And that delays, that, you know, delays the restoration efforts by hours and hours. We kind of established a paradigm where you would have your geospatial information overlaid on reality so that you wouldn't have to actually know anything about, you know, utility distribution equipment in the field. All you had to do is look around and say, oh, that isn't there anymore. And the application would know what all the equipment that was in that circle that you just drew in the air, and send that real time back to the main office so it could be kitted up for the next truck roll. So that was a huge, huge increase in productivity. And we were getting these huge increases in productivity on virtually everything we tried, whether it was, you know, putting out telecom equipment, having linemen put out telecom equipment, or doing subterranean vault inspections and things like that. The increase in productivity was just enormous. And that became actually a problem. If you go to, you know, your typical executive and say, I can improve productivity by 4%, they'll buy into that. If you go to them and say, I can improve productivity by 40%, they're probably not going to believe you. But those are the kinds of percentages in increases in productivity that we were seeing in the utility space. So basically, any kind of a task that involves, you know, manual operations or maintenance of assets or location of assets or complex assembly tasks or picking the right parts or staying in the right part of the plant or the substation, you know, having audio or visual or haptic cues of events, any kind of a situation where you have that can be improved by the augmented reality. It really was astounding. And then we also saw, I'll stop there and you probably have more questions.
Yeah. So this is all smart glasses, right?
I'm generally talking about smart glasses, but it can also be, like I said, little transducers that might vibrate on your, you know, an insert to your glove or something that would vibrate when you're about to touch something that's got a potential on it. It could be an auditory thing. You know, in construction, one of the biggest ways that people get hurt and killed are they're backed over by equipment, whether it's a truck or a backhoe or something. And being able to see the equipment and having the application know where you are in relationship to that equipment and which way the equipment's going can be a lifesaver. And an auditory or a haptic, a physical vibration or something is a great way of telling the worker that something's going on. They got to look around.
So What barriers do you see in integrating smart glasses? We had a lot of, you know, our members in particular who, you know, started using smart glasses much more frequently with the pandemic, and they're seeing some great, you know, uses, but, you know, and you've suggested some additional uses that they could use here, but what are the barriers and, you know, what tips do you have for overcoming them?
When people started writing augmented reality apps, what they tried to do is they tried to supplant existing applications. Like somebody would, you know, reach out to me and say, hey, I've got this great asset management application that's based on augmented reality. And I'm like, whoop, time out. No utility, and I'm guessing no company is going to change their asset management system to something just because you can now provide augmented reality. That's a feature. It's not the mission. Okay. What I tried to engender in the vendor community is you need to be able to interface with existing, you know, legacy software systems. You know, you need to create an interface that will allow your augmented reality to interface with multiple systems through some sort of standard interface that are now being developed by the augmented reality folks. Nobody's going to throw out their systems just because you can project data from that system on reality. It's got to be useful for it. The other thing is that people need to realize that augmented reality isn't used in every single set of commands or every single use case. The other problem that vendors were doing early on is they tried to make an entire process, you know, model an entire process on augmented reality. It gets to be very expensive. So again, what we tried to do is focus down is where can the augmented reality actually add value, and when is it just window dressing? That would greatly reduce the cost for clients of these augmented reality vendors. And we had a lot of success with that. We had a lot of symposiums and whatnot and webcasts and stuff on how to build augmented reality applications, in my case, specifically for the utility industry. But the principles apply, you know, pretty much across the board.
And you mentioned Pokemon Go helped with this, but how do you convince skeptics of the benefits of using these tools? Because, you know, it's not super comfortable to have an extra, you know, thing on your face. And, you know, what if you already wear glasses? I have questions.
Yeah. I think the best thing is to see a demo. There's one video that we did with Duke Energy. And I hope I'm not going to get sued for mentioning the name of the company. But anyway, they were trying out an augmented reality app to help them do storm and damage assessment. And we gave the guys these devices. They clipped right on their helmets, had a little flip down TV screen. So some of the purists would say, if you're not using both eyes, it's not augmented reality. But as I said, that's not my definition of augmented reality. So they, you know, they can flip this thing down, they can look around, they can see where assets are supposed to be, what's missing, all of that stuff, and report back. And when you see these guys, you know, we had a mix of linemen from, you know, mid late 20s up to guys that were, you know, fairly seasoned like me, you know, in their 60s. And they picked this up in literally minutes. It was absolutely astounding how quickly they picked this up. And then when they saw that how much this improved their capability of doing the job, they were just effusive in their praise. And we got all that on video. So that's the kind of thing that a lot of times you need to do. There's some vendors out there that have their own very good videos about how they've come in and improved processes and whatnot. There's one vendor that did applications for a company that builds nuclear submarines. And the nuclear submarines, you know, are built in tubes that they assemble, a whole bunch of tubes. And in order to drop them into place with a crane, they have to put in all kinds of temporary bracing. And then after they get everything welded together, they got to take all the bracing out. So they would go through with, you know, the old process was going through with a bunch of schematics and whatnot and finding these things and cutting them out and whatnot. And the augmented reality company said, okay, we put all of your schematic or all of your design drawings in this application, go back and do it again. And so the guy that, and he'd been doing this for 20 years, 25 years, you know, and he thought he had everything out of the submarine. And he went back in there and just found all kinds of stuff that was left behind. And of course they got it all in video. So he was very, very impressed. And those are the kind of things that I think would sell even, you know, to folks that are very skeptical about the process. Once they realize that it's not a gimmick, it's a tool to be used in limited applications, but it really enhances how quickly and safely folks do their job and greatly reduces the amount of rework and errors that occur. Most people have to buy into that. I mean, the numbers are just there right in front of them.
All right, so switching gears, like you did with your career, you're now working in education. You know, what uses do you see for AR as we train future scientists and engineers?
A couple of things. Probably one of the big things for engineers, and we're actually seeing this in the industry, you know, not every engineering school has a big piece of equipment that they're working on. Say it's a jet engine or something. You know, some of the big state schools may have an honest to God GE blah, blah, blah sitting there, and they can all huddle around it and look at it. And the professor can go on about it, the design and whatnot. A lot of schools don't have that, or they might have one piece, not another, you know, but with augmented and virtual reality, for that matter, you can take people anywhere and expose them to equipment that for all intents and purposes is sitting right there in front of them. So a bunch of people could be virtually standing around a piece of equipment and even standing around a piece of virtual equipment, and the people are geographically dispersed. You know, you could have avatars for each person and they could be anywhere in the world, and you're standing around the same assembly or some assembly or piece of equipment or a spar or something like that, and you're talking about it, and you can interact as if you were all there. And for engineers, that's really, really handy. Then the ability, you know, in where I work, you know, they're big on ceramics and glass, and the ability to see like molecules in space, or the crystal structure of something in space, or a material's microstructure, you know, and be able to actually go into it and look around, that is a huge thing. But more fundamentally, psychologists, like our psychology department is working on this. Psychologists have known that people learn in different modes. Some people can like sit there, and like when I was in college, I got to the point where I really didn't have to take notes. Like if I just went to class and I sat there, I could pick up on what's going on and get good grades. Other people have to read it. Other people have to experience it. Well, the advantage of augmented and virtual reality is that you can hit all of these modes at the same time. So you can give what's known as multimodal instructions. And some of the folks I deal with or I've dealt with, they incorporate this into the training. You know, corporate training tends to be, you get a bunch of men and women in their early 20s are all sitting there in a conference room, and a guy walks in pushing a TV, and he's got a bunch of VHS tapes under his arm and a bunch of manuals under this arm, and he sets them down. He starts handing out manuals. I have kids. I'm 61, so I can call people in their 20s and 30s kids. Kids today don't learn that way. If you come out with the VHS tapes and the manuals, their eyes are going to roll back in their head. These are people that have grown up with video games. So And again, these have been measured in the study, but when you present them the same data in a multimodal kind of environment where you've got, say, an ebook that has augmented reality built into it, along with other visual and auditory kind of content, the increase in productivity is hard to sell to people because it's so big. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had utilities that have taken an apprenticeship from 3 years down to a year and a half because of how quickly the trainees are picking up on the material using this kind of multimodal process.
That's amazing. So how do you know, going even younger, you know, what do you think the implications are for K-12 education? You know, we're trying to get people involved in STEM and keep them there. And, you know, how do you see it playing out there?
It's very similar. The experiences are different, but it's very similar. Being able to put something in front of kids that's three-dimensional, that's kind of like the video games they spend 12 hours a day on, is incredibly valuable. And then when you have kids that are ADHD or autistic, you know, on the autism spectrum, they really shine with this multimodal kind of teaching environment. You know, if a kid is prone to be looking around and basically the lesson is looking around with him, that's very helpful for them. And kids who are autistic or on the spectrum somewhere, they can be guided by this multimodal kind of structure. Some of the kids are sensitive to sound. Some of them are sensitive to touch. Some of them are sensitive to bright lights and whatnot. And you can really tailor the experience. And I have a tendency to call these little vignettes of augmented and virtual reality experiences rather than software or whatever. If you can tailor the experience to fit the way this kid learns, then you can expect a lot better outcome from them. But all the things about being able to take the poorest school in the inner city or out in Appalachia and bring in things that they will never experience in an elementary school and virtually plunk it down in front of them is huge. And it really can't be underestimated of how much this is going to improve the learning process.
Amazing. What are some other unexpected uses that you've seen in development? You mentioned, you know, working with people on the autism spectrum. You know, what's some other stuff that you're hearing about?
There's a lot going on in medicine. And again, if you're trying to study medicine in some third world country, and they don't have a hospital that does the kind of surgery that you're interested in, you can pretty much tap into that surgery anywhere in the world. And being able to look and see what the surgeon sees, and in some cases, feel what the surgeon feels. You know, we keep talking, coming back to haptics. You know, how does a tumor feel inside, I don't know, a liver or something like that? You can actually convey that kind of information back without, you know, having to actually put your hands on a patient. That's a huge thing. In construction, that was another early adopter. There's some great construction examples out there where buildings have been built and there's a little fiducial marker, like a QC code on the door. And after the building is built, you can look at that QC marker, and then you can look at everything involved in that room. Let's just say it's a room that, say, a medical facility, and they've got airlines in the walls and plumbing, all kinds of fancy stuff in the walls. And you can go and you can look at what's there, and then you can go and look up the entire history of whatever device you're looking at. Say it's a complex, you know, valve for providing oxygen to patients or something. You can go all the way back to the quote on that or to the purchase order on that and get all of the information and bring it up while you're standing there in the actual room. So, you know, kind of troubleshooting and getting knowing what parts to get and from whom and all of that stuff for replacement tasks, it becomes so much easier rather than coming in the room, looking around, going back somewhere, and looking it up online, having to go back to the room. It's that ability to bring what you're looking at and what you're trying to do right together. Mm. So that you're doing it while you're looking at it. And that's, in my mind, that's the huge advantage for something like augmented reality.
That's awesome. So we're going to open the floor to questions in a minute, and we've already got at least one that's come in. But first, I want you to tell us about the work you're doing at Alfred. Sure. And your other passion, advanced ceramic technology. You've got a lot going on.
Well, I actually, my engineering degree is in ceramic engineering. I have a BS and a PhD. And I did ceramic engineering for about 5 years. I worked in a plant that made components for millimeter and microwave communications. And then I, fraternity brother talked me into joining his consulting company, which became a software company, which I wrote the first software. Long story short, it was a very long, strange trip. All of a sudden, I ended up for the last 20 years of my life in the energy field, including my 10 years at EPRI. Where I am, Alfred University, kind of focus on kind of these niche engineering curriculum, glass, ceramics materials, biomedical materials. We have the only glass engineering school in the world, only one of two ceramic engineering schools in the country, only one of two in renewable energy engineering in the world. So we also have a very large mechanical engineering. But I'm kind of combining all of these things. Not every ceramic engineering tends to focus on the material, where the molecules are, what additives you put in there and all that kind of stuff. But there's a large overlap with the other engineering curriculum. So I'm taking more of a holistic approach to research at Alfred University. And I'm trying slowly to work in some augmented reality. So we'll see how that works out. Mostly I'm working with the psychology department in doing stuff with people with PTSD and autistic people and stuff like that. We also have a very large, very famous art school here that was part of the College of Ceramics. And they have a whole program on visual art that's got a lot of augmented reality involved in it. And that art is kind of neat because, again, it's experiential. You're not just looking at something. You're actually walking into it and experiencing it all over the place. The other place, the area we're doing this with, is we have several museums. And we're trying to curate the museums using augmented reality. So when you see, you know, a glass vase that was made in the, you know, third century or something like that, you know, information can pop up and you can dive as deep as you want into it. You can even do things like look at a CAT scan of the object and kind of slice through it and see how it was made, look at it from the inside as well as the outside, those kinds of things.
Oh, that's very cool.
It's very exciting work.
Yeah. I love all the kind of cross-pollination with psychology and art and engineering. It sounds like this is going to be amazing. I can't wait to see where it goes beyond Pokemon Go.
Yeah, eventually you will live in an augmented world where you are interfacing with augmented reality constantly, and you won't even think any more of it, you know, than you do picking up your cell phone now. I mean, if you remember, you know, back in the 90s, it didn't, your first instinct to call somebody wasn't to pick up your cell phone. Mm. And now, you know, you can't live without it. There's all kinds of things on the cell phone that you rely on a minute by minute basis. And augmented reality is going to be probably as big as cell phone technology once it's kind of permeates the entire ecosystem.
So that actually segues really well into our first question, which is about, you know, basically mental health and physical health, you know, using these tools, you know, do we find that people are more tired? Does it impact employee mental health, well-being, you know, I guess, you know, the first concern is it going to impact people negatively having these in front of their faces all day? Like, how does that work?
Well, EPRI has a program on ergonomics and utility health and safety. It's been around for ages. And we worked with those folks to devise some experiments where we would look at, you know, a person wearing a headset. And we tried a couple of different headsets that were popular at the time. Headsets to see if it impacted their eyes. You can measure things like blink rate and the amount your eyes are twitching and things like that. And then there were sensors that were put up on their back and their neck and whatnot to try and measure whether or not their head was drooping. And so far we haven't found any impact. Now, no study to my knowledge, no studies have been done yet what daily wear over a couple of years can do, but we're kind of, you know, it's one of those things where you have to implement it in order to measure it. But we did find basically no impact with people wearing them for a day or two at a time. No impact in things like climbing up and down ladders, getting in on and off trucks. There's a term for it that the health and safety people use. I can't recall, but it's basically your basic average work tasks. And there was no impact in that. There was a marginal difference on the use of essentially a two screen or a one screen headset. But whether or not it's significant, I'm not really sure. So the other thing that if you go down the headset road rather than, you know, looking at it on a device, you got to match the headset up with the use case and the environment. Is it indoors? Is it outdoors? Is it above ground? Is it below ground? Is it in a building? Out of the building? What's the electromagnetic spectrum around you? All that kind of stuff, which, you know, people can guide you through this process. So where was I going with that? What was the question?
Just if there's an impact on employee well-being.
So far, so good. Whether it eventually drives somebody crazy. I would like to figure out how much information a person can ingest, you know, through audio or visual cues or whatever before it becomes distracting. That work really hasn't, again, to the best of my knowledge, hasn't been done. I think it's a really, really important work. EPRI did some work ages ago on, like in power plants, how many error signals or warnings can you ingest before it just becomes nuts and you can't deal with it anymore? And the same kind of thing needs to be done with augmented reality, I think.
Okay. And so the next one was, what kind of productivity increase have you seen if you had to quantify it?
I would say that the productivity increases were anywhere from like 10 to 40%. The drop in errors, you know, like the Boeing study, you could look up the Boeing study on augmented reality, just Google that, but it went down to virtually nothing. The issue is, and where you get some cross technology interactions here is, I also worked on artificial intelligence at EPRI, which I also saw as a kid. But you can tell somebody not to turn the knob to the right. With augmented reality, you can show, you know, you can give them an arrow, you can put a little hand out there and make it, you know, like this, but you can't really tell if they turn the knob to the right. And that's where the artificial intelligence comes in. And right towards the end of my stay at EPRI, we were looking at verifying using AI, verifying that the task was actually completed to what we told them to do. Some things in utilities, it could be with utilities, errors can have just dramatic impacts. somebody in New York City does something wrong and the New York Stock Exchange goes down. That's not acceptable. So, you know, Con Ed does an amazing job of double, triple, quadruple redundancies or whatnot, but you're always got the human element. And you need to make sure that people are doing what their instructions are telling them to do, whether it's paper instructions or augmented reality instructions. And that's where the headset can provide double duty, you know, telling them what to do, how to do it, exactly how far to do it, but also figure out whether or not they did it right or not.
Awesome. And one more that came in is, you know, what were the PTSD applications that you saw or that you're developing? Well,
this work is early and ongoing. When you deal with human subjects, especially things like PTSD, the process for getting approval for working on subjects is a rather long one. Mm-hmm. And we're going through that process. I do know that, and you can look this up online, that there is some work, ongoing work on essentially providing soothing environments for people who are somehow emotionally distressed. That's going on. I'm interested in, you know, PTSD for some personal reasons, but you can change people's their outlook, their media outlook, by providing certain imagery. There's a flip side to this. One thing that the military could be looking at, and I'm not sure they are looking at, is providing imagery and, you know, auditory and haptic inputs that would make soldiers braver, you know, turn everybody into a Medal of Honor winner kind of mentality. And I think, I'm not a psychologist, but I just the impression I get and from what I've seen and what I've read, you can do a lot to change people's emotional state with the appropriate stimulation in a real-time environment.
Ooh. That sounds intense. Well, I guess we'll have to keep watch for that one. Did anyone else? Oh, one more. What wearable AR devices are emerging outside of HoloLens?
I can say this now. When I was at EPRI, you couldn't say, oh, my favorite one is this. But there's a device out there. It's the HMT-1 by RealWear. It snaps onto a standard helmet. You know, there was a smart helmet company out there that burned through umpteen million dollars and never had a product. And I pointed out to them, you know, their hard hats aren't all the same. They have different grades and regulations and stuff. But what the RealWear people did is basically any MSA compliant helmet, you can snap this thing on, or they could wear it with a headband or whatever. And it's the one with the TV that flips down. And, you know, so you can do it this way. It's reversible. So all you got to do is flip it over, flip it the other way, and you can use it on your left eye. It's got all kinds of sensors and stuff. It's got a voice command, and the voice commands that we did in at Duke Energy, some of the guys were definitely from North Carolina with their accent. The guy that was running the program was Serbian. So he had an accent, and the microphone and the speech to text picked up on all of that, translated it correctly or transliterated it correctly, even in noisy environments. So I really like the HMT-1. It's also easy to program too.
Yeah, I think a lot of our members are using that one in the pandemic, at least the RealWear in tools in general. Yeah. All right, any other questions before we wrap up? You can feel free to jump in and have the conversation too. You don't have to type.
You can also give my information. I'm simmons@alfred.edu, and my last name is spelled funny. It's S-I-M-M-I-N-S. And I guess somebody way back when got kicked out of the family or something and changed the spelling. But simmons@alfred.edu, be happy to talk to you about it.
Awesome. Well, John, this has been fascinating, fantastic, wonderful. I'm sure everyone's gonna rush out and start downloading Pokemon Go. That's it.
Well, if you can't get enough of me, just Google my last name and the phrase augmented reality, and there's a couple hours worth of me out there blathering on about augmented reality when I was at UPRI.
Well, it's fascinating. I love it. You came to me, well, how many years ago was that? And I was like, what's this augmented reality stuff this guy's talking about? And I still remember, like, oh, the backup camera. That's what that Simmons guy told me was AR.
Exactly. Yeah, that's Simmons guy. So anyway, yeah, it's been a long, strange trip, but it's been a lot of fun.
It's awesome. And I can't wait to hear how everything goes at Alfred with all of the different cross-functional, cross-disciplinary efforts that you're working on there. That sounds amazing. We'll have to have you back when things have moved on a bit.
Yeah, every 5-10 years, have me back.
Awesome.
Okay.
All right. Well, John, thank you so much. And thanks everyone for joining us this afternoon. And we'll see you next month when I'll be interviewing Randall Wright of MIT on July 21st. All right. Thanks, everyone.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.